Welcome to Politics and Right. My name is Egberto Willis, your host. Good morning, Houston. Good morning, Harris County. Good morning to the great state of Texas. And of course,
families have a lot going on. Let Ollie help manage the mental load with new cognitive health supplements for everyone 4 and up, like delicious Lolly Focus Pops or Lolly Mellow Pops for kids. And for parents, try 3 new Brainy Chews to help you focus, chill out, or get energized. Find these cognitive health buddies for the whole fam at Ollie.com. That's OLLY.com. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.
Of course, good morning to United States of America. Good morning to every nook and cranny that receives our 100,000 watt transmitters signal, Northeast Texas, Southeast Texas, Northwest Louisiana, Southwest Louisiana, and all nooks and crannies where these great signals permeate from the hands of Howard Reynolds and Jack Van Bibber, the ones who make things happen in our studio. Anyway, folks, we're going to have a great program for you today. Welcome to the rest of the world, those that are listening over the internet. And believe it or not, we have quite a few people are, in fact, interested in American politics. Anyway, good morning, my brothers inside of the studio at Caroline. How are you doing this morning?
We're good, Egberto. It's a single genii today.
Oh, okay. Well, we'll take whatever we can get. How you doing? How you doing, my brother?
I'm good.
Great.
I'm good, sir.
Great. What's the word of the day, Jack?
Well, the word of the day is it's about war and soldiers. There are no heroes in a war waged on the innocent, only guilty barbarians.
I love that. You have it short, tight, and concise. Wow. That is, you know what? That is so true. You know, when we go ahead and put that on what's going on in Gaza right now, that is exactly what you look at. You know, it's like, madre mia, look at the destruction. Look at the guys perpetrating the greatest massacre on human beings in a long time.
Yes.
Numerically speaking, look at what's happening, folks. Please do not allow verbiage. Don't allow others to tell you what your eyes are seeing isn't true. The only way we are going to get a world that is equitable, a world that we all want to live in, is for us to be truthful with what's going on. Because when we lie to ourselves, when we lie to what's really happening, irrespective of what your ideology or whatever that is, we're not fooling the world. We're not fooling anything else. We're just fooling ourselves. In the case of what's going on in Gaza, when you look at the facts of what's going on in Gaza, forget about what you believe about Israel, what you believe about Palestine. That's right now. Put that on the back burner. Just look at humanity. Look at what occurred in Israel that was a catalyst to the current murder of over 33,000 innocent Palestinians in Gaza. Forget about the history for now. Just look at the reality of the destruction, the catastrophic destruction of human beings and property relative to the destruction what occurred in Israel by crooks or by terrorists who Netanyahu knew was being funded, an action Netanyahu knew was coming. And you wonder sometimes, why did he allow it to occur? Why did it take 13 hours before any assistance got to the Gaza border? And you realize, you know what? It's a whole bunch of liberals and progressives that live along the border. People who really want to have peace with Jews, who really want to have peace with Palestinians. Could that be a factor in why support for that area was so slow, even as West Bank territories were being taken and confiscated, etc.? War is a nasty thing. But I tell you, war with this kind of intent is even more evil. Folks, don't let your eyes not see. Let's not have your eyes not believe what you're seeing. It's important. It's important for you not to do that. It's important for Biden to stop doing that. Although I think that's for another story. But anyway, today the title of the show is, go ahead, Jack. Go ahead.
Yeah, you know, that statement sounded a little harsh, you know, and it's not meant to demean the soldiers out there. It's just meant to make you aware that you may be being used for an ulterior purpose. And the fallout that comes after the deal is done and they come home and they have to deal with the PTSD. You know where that's at.
Yeah. Jack, first of all, please, your statement didn't sound harsh in my opinion at all. At all. I mean, like I said, the truth is the truth is the truth. And what our leaders are doing, and including our leader Netanyahu is not just harming and murdering and genocidal with Palestine. That's not his only crime. His crime is what he's doing with the 20-something-year-old Jewish soldier who they are encouraging to commit these atrocities, like Palestinians, like the Hamas executed atrocities in Israel. They are teaching a lot of young Jewish good brothers and sisters to be okay with the atrocities being committed in Gaza. It's not only Palestinians getting killed and maimed. It is Jewish peoples whose hearts and souls are taken into another dimension. They are making harming other human beings vogue. They are making hate even deeper vogue. They are creating another generation of terrorists looking for revenge. And I'm not only talking about creating terrorists on the Palestinian side, I'm talking about creating terrorists on the Jewish side, Israeli side as well. There are no winners in the kind of murdering that Netanyahu is executing right now in Gaza. And that we have allowed ourselves to be relatively complicit in this, history will judge us. We thought as a country, the United States of America, we have been attempting to atone for much of what we have done to other human beings in this country. We have been atoning. We have been doing well in atoning. It's a slow process, but we've been doing it. We don't need to backslide. We don't need to allow another country to make us complicit in the backsliding in the way we treat humanity. We don't need that. And I think maybe those in power are starting to come to grasp with what we're doing and realizing that Netanyahu ain't no ally. Netanyahu is really just a murdering, genocidal prime minister that is bringing harm to our good friend Israel, to our good friend Palestine, to our good friends around the world. And notice I'm making no distinction, our good friends Israel and our good friends Palestine. We are for humanity. We must be for humanity. We must be for humanity, people. And we can't have a double standard, especially given our history. Especially given our history, we can't support what Netanyahu and the IDF is doing. And it harms us as Americans as well. It endangers us as Americans. In fact, we are already endangered because of what we have been complicit with. It is important that we see this. Before I get into the title of the program today is Vietnam cracks down on billionaire fraud, rich funds impoverished impoverishment of many, and an O.J. Simpson story. And I'm going to start with the O.J. Simpson story with an interview I did with a friend of mine, a publicist in Hollywood, who is a booking agent as well. She normally calls me up and says, hey, Berto, I need you to interview this person. They wrote a great book that's of value to the progressive movement. She's a strong progressive, and she had a story to tell. I'm going to play that after I speak to Brother Donald here on the other side. Come on, Brother Daniel. Come on in.
Good morning, Alberto. How are you?
Good morning, my brother. Talk to me.
Okay. Do you think you could write a speech and get all your thoughts of how you want the world to change in a few sentences?
You know what is amazing? A friend of mine, actually it's a supporter of mine on my 3 o'clock show, they read my book, Tribulations of an Afro-Latino Caribbean Man. Racism didn't stop my smile, hope, or journey forward. And he wrote me while I was doing the show live. He said, man, I just got to read in the book. He said, you know what would be a great book? For you to first tell people why you became a progressive and the things that you really, really believe in. Because he said, man, that world seems like something we would want. And it's funny because I reminded him, hey, I wrote two other ones. It's Worth It, How to Talk to Your Right-Wing Relatives, Friends, and Neighbors, and How to Make America Utopia. My thoughts, you know. But he wanted something deeper. And yes, the answer to that is yes. I have two other books, and the third book that two other books that I've already started writing. And the other one is going to take what you just said along with what my brother who listens to the 3 o'clock program told me. Because I think. It's important that you not only talk about what problems are, but you talk about what can be. And I think what we lack many times is what can be. Go ahead, brother.
Okay, so if you were set up, you could finish something, correct?
Yes, sir.
With a speech. Okay, would you dress up like Albert Einstein? Now, I know you're going to look like a Don King Albert Einstein. But
are you trying to tell me that I'm black, dude? Is that what you're trying to tell me?
Well, in case your listeners didn't know, we're on the radio. I didn't want them to know.
I'm messing with you, man. Hey,
I didn't want them to be surprised.
Oh, okay. Okay, look, let me tell you.
We all share a common DNA, correct?
We all came from Africa, all of us, whether you're white, black, blue, Chinese, or whatever. In fact, there are some interesting genomics with Nelson Mandela, but we'll talk about that some other time. But yeah, I think that's a good idea, my brother.
And you have a college degree, correct?
Yes, sir.
Okay, so if you could show everybody in the world with a song, would you do it?
Of course.
Okay. Now, what? This is the song. It's a intro, verse, chorus, verse, then a bridge,
mm-hmm.
and then an interrupted chorus, mm-hmm. and then you give your speech, and
okay.
then musical outro. Okay? I got you hooked now. All you got to do when I pause is say what. You know how you say I am what? Out?
Yeah.
You just say what.
Okay.
Okay.
Yeah.
And then you got to give your speech. Okay, are you ready? No, I can't see. But it's a song. It's yours. It's Egberto's song.
Okay, I'm listening.
Are you? Egberto Einstein is a friend of mine. He can fix about anything. Fix you a drink, help you fix your car, give you a ride home from the local bar, but there's just one thing. You got to say what?
What?
You can't fix no broken heart, one that's been stepped on and torn apart. You can patch it up for a while, get a few laughs and a couple of smiles, give it some time, and it'll all fall apart. Then it goes into music. And then his great uncle was a genius, you see. All that stuff for relativity and matters of the brain, man, hell, he was pretty smart. He tried love a time or two. There was one thing he could conclude.
What? You what?
you can't. There's a problem with their brains. He found out they're all insane, and you can't fix no broken heart. You can't fix no broken heart. And then your chorus stops and says, wait, wait, hurting people hurt people. Then you go, let me see, let me think. You go into your speech, and then you turn back, smile at the camera, pull out your conductor stick, and your chorus comes in and says, we can all fix those broken hearts. With love and compassion is where it starts. And then you rewrite the chorus. And then it goes to an outro musical. And then as the circle is closing in, you grab that black circle, look at an alien, look back at the camera and say, I am what? And you drop your mic into the multiverse before it goes doop to the end. Now there's your song. Do with it what you like.
Hey, wait a minute. But let me ask you before you go. Did you write those words?
Well, I wrote the song for my buddy. We were working on an in-frame on his 18-wheeler, and a bunch of us were hanging out, and we're not musically inclined, but anyway. But that was his song, but I changed some lyrics up and everything, because halfway through when everybody was laughing, I realized that he still cared about his wife, and I couldn't finish the final chorus. So I'm giving it to you. Finish the final chorus. Finish the speech.
Can I clap for you, brother? I am clapping for you. I mean, I'm impressed. I'm impressed. But you always call here. Every now and then you say something that the women want me to slap you around for. But other than that, you're a good-hearted, good person. Thank you, Brother Donald. You have a great one. Okay,
real quick. The problem with their brain, he found out they're all insane, is a video running behind you. And it's showing Stalin, Hitler, everything else. And then you can even put Trump, the jury's out. You could put Netanyahu and all the other ones we have questions about. Because that's what I'm talking about. I was talking about women in general when I wrote it for him. But, okay, later. Have a good weekend. Ponder on that.
Thank you. Yes, Donald. Thank you. You're a good man. You have a great day. Let's go to Harry, and then I play that video. Harry, how are you doing, my brother?
I'm good. Love Donald's poetry. He's a great caller. Love his enlightenment. Since you're going to talk about OJ, I'll tell you some things that I know about with OJ. When I grew up in San Bruno, California, and I told you about my dad's career, how he was in the Air Force, and then his second career was a dentist. Well, when I grew up in San Bruno, California, there was this family called the Bakers, and I found out that at that time when I was like 8, 9, 10 years old that they were OJ's cousins. And then where my dad worked at Potrero Hill Health Center, where O.J. Simpson grew up, was down the street across the street from his health clinic that he worked in as a dentist. And so when I'd go up there for appointments and to see my dad, he had to do dentistry on me. I would see the house that O.J. Grew up in. But all that aside, what happened with OJ, I was talking with a friend on text, and he was talking about, OJ said this over the years, I'm not black, I'm OJ. So I responded to my friend of what Malcolm X said in the 1962 speech in Los Angeles, California, when some Nation of Islam people, one of them got killed and a few of the others got wounded in a shootout by the Los Angeles Police Department. And he said, I just said, who taught you to hate yourself? And O.J. Simpson, a lot of years, was taught to reject his blackness. That's just too bad. As far as the criminal trial, I felt that O.J. Simpson was guilty, as a lot of people did, because what I couldn't get past, even though Van Adder and Mark Furman was proven to be a racist, and Van Adder was gone with that vial for 2 hours, and who knows what he could have done with the vial. The Gil Garcetti prosecution team, they screwed it up with Christopher Darden concentrating on the glove. The civil team did the right thing with those Bruno Mali shoes, because it clearly showed that the Bruno Mali shoe, the murderer, had Bruno Mali shoes on, and they proved that OJ wore those when he worked as an NFL analyst, and they saw that he wore those shoes. And when he was interviewed during the civil trial, he said, I had nothing to do with those ugly, expletive shoes. I would never wear them. But, you know, they screwed that up. And so in the criminal trial, that jury, you know, many of them, I think Brenda Moran said, look, they didn't prove their case. And Barry Sheck did a good job. with exploiting with the blood samples, and F. Lee Bailey, and of course Johnny Cochran did a good job proving that Mark Furman and Alan Dershowitz behind the scenes that Mark Furman was a racist.
You know, let me just say, Harry. Look, I think all of us, I think everybody, I don't know anybody that doesn't think O.J. was guilty. I think O.J. killed that woman. In fact, since we kind of spent more time than I expected
and her friend,
to in the beginning,
Rob Logan.
Yeah, even though we spent more time, because we spent more time kind of talking between Donald and you, I'm not going to play the O.J. video because there's a more important video I want to play. But here's the deal, and I want to talk about it with you here, and that is, I think America has to understand what really occurred there. When you saw a whole lot of black people jumping up and cheering, that superseded the heinous crime that was committed on Nicole Simpson. And the publicist that called me yesterday, she said, like, she used to jog with Nicole, and she was ashamed of seeing that Nicole had all these bruises on her body, but she never said anything. Yep. And she just spoke about how revered O.J. was in that community, a very white community. And she said, this is a white publicist, and she tells me, you know, O.J., when O.J. said something like, I'm not black, I am O.J., you know, it may sound bad to black people when he said it, but that was sort of true. O.J. was O.J. O.J. could do, I mean, O.J. was never seen as a black icon or anything like that. He was seen as O.J. That was an institution, and that's how people saw him. But what black folk look at O.J., when I say black folk, I'm talking about folks here, looked at that case was like, wow, finally a black person got the system, right? It had nothing to do with Nicole Simpson. Everybody hated that Nicole Simpson was murdered, and they had compassion for her, but it was a fight between, remember, that came right after Rodney King and all of that. It was a thing against the system. And I wish more people, instead of saying, oh, we had the big black and white divide, I wish more people had seen it for the power structure, somebody like O.J., you know, they shared nothing in common with O.J., you know, but that somebody beat the system. Then that's what it was all about, you know. So I'm not saying that it's correct or not. I'm just saying that's how it was. But thank you for bringing that up, Brother Harry, as usual.
I believe you 100%. I was going to say is Dr. John, our caller, Dr. John, knows about this. O.J., unfortunately, did not look after his health because he died of prostate cancer. And with prostate, what I understand about prostate cancer and colon cancer, when you are 45, you should always, and I've been having my check regularly, because if you let that go, if you don't catch it early, and O.J. may have just let it go, it can spread and kill you. And so, you know, that's a lesson. Let that be a lesson to people to always have your prostate when you get into your mid-40s and you're up and your colon checked regularly. Because if they catch the cancer early, you can manage it and they can get rid of the cancer before
you know. Harry, you're giving great advice that even with my own irresponsibility of not going to doctors, I should heed. Maybe at some point in time, I will learn that lesson from you, sir. I am not a good spokesman.
Dr. John, our friend, Dr. John, that called you.
Thank you, brother.
Well. Yeah.
Thank you, brother. You're absolutely right. I'm absolutely wrong on that particular case. Anyway, and, you know, I am wrong for not going to doctors, right? I just have a thing with the healthcare system, and I'm wrong. I just want folks to know that. Take the advice from Brother Harry. Anyway, folks, you know, Lena Hidalgo has been trying to get a basic income sort of experiment done here in Houston, where I think 1,800 families would get something like $500 a month for a year, with the expectation that they would use that to improve their lives, make some changes so that eventually they won't need basic income. But basic income is something that I support wholeheartedly. You know, corporations get basic income. They don't tell you, they don't call it basic income, but subsidies that corporations get to stay in business all of the time. So when you hear about it, that's nothing more than basic income, and it's no damn experiment. This is really the transfer of your money to corporations, which who owns corporations? Generally wealthy people. Now, that said, we have Betancourt and these other people stopping Lina Hidalgo from doing this, given the basic income, claiming it's some sort of socialism or social experiment or whatever. Well, you know, the private sector, good people in the private, in the nonprofit sector have already done the experiments that prove that if you give people a hand up, what they really do is become self-sufficient. You put your boot on their necks. They don't get a chance to come above water. And I go to these conferences every year, Netroots Nation every year, and I interview hundreds of people over the years. And one of the things that intrigued me the most was the basic income experiment. And I interviewed this guy, Conrad Shaw. Conrad Shaw started the experiment with his nonprofit, and he came back in 2022, and he looked me up while I was doing all these interviews, and he said, "I've got some results for you." And this is the interview that I want to play here. So when you're being ill-informed and trying to make it seem like basic income is a giveaway amount of money to a whole bunch of losers, let's stick with the science. Let's stick with the facts that our society can be just that, a society that helps people. Check this out, then we'll take it on the other side.
Welcome to another edition of Politics Done Right. We're coming live from Netroots Nation 2022. We are honored today to have Conrad Shaw once again. The last time I saw you was in 2019 in Philadelphia. And let me tell you, you spoke to us about basic income. First of all, before we get started, reintroduce yourself and the company that or the organization that you're with.
Yeah, my name is Conrad Shaw. I've been a universal basic income activist for six years now. I'm here with two projects. One is a docu-series called Bootstraps that has been exploring the idea of basic income for the last little while. And I'm also working with a startup company called Comingle that's trying to create the first online basic income community.
Right. Now, you just kind of tickle my interest. How do you have a basic income community online? What is that all about?
Yeah, so I came into this work thinking, okay, the end goal is you have to get the government to do a basic income. For it to be a real basic income, they have to do it in such a way that everyone gets it and we all pay taxes, whatever, it's worked out.
Right.
And just in the last couple of years, I sort of realized, you know, tech platforms have a lot of power, and they have very big communities, and they're essentially their own little nations, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Their power rivals nation states. Like, we don't even know what to do with them.
Right.
So what if we build something that's a people-powered thing that has its own effective sort of taxation structure, and the whole purpose of this little government, this little nation, is to provide basic income to all its members? So it's essentially it's like a mutual aid service, a place where people come and they can pool money along a basic income model.
Right.
So the nuts and bolts are everybody who joins commits to contributing 7% of their income into a pot each week. And then the money goes into the pot, gets divvied up exactly equally and given back out to everybody. So what that means is if you have $100 in income one week, then you contribute $7, so 7%. And if the payout of the eventual pot is $50, you just came out $43 ahead. That same week, if someone made, you know, $1,000 and contributes 70, they put in 70, got back out 50. So they end up putting in 20, right? So it becomes a redistributive mechanism for people to pool money so that it's basically a solidarity effort in which no one in the group ever sees a week where they have no income.
Right.
It's like,
right,
give money when you got it, get money when you need
that's
it.
That's going to be a very good experiment, because that also that depends on folks to, it's almost like insurance, right?
Yeah. And it's not insurance for the big disasters and things.
Right.
It's sort of, because you get it no matter what every week. It's right. Insurance for the day to day, whatever pops up in your life. Have a little bit of money with which to deal with it.
You know, now, how do you monitor the person is going to give their 7%? Because it depends on a certain degree of compliance.
Yeah, right. So that's part of building this thing to work effectively is just the suite of financial technology tools. Make sure people are connecting all their relevant bank accounts. You right. don't want someone connecting their like fake bank account and then making right. money elsewhere and not contributing
right.
and taking advantage of the system.
Right. right.
So we have to build in the security measures to make sure that people are actually reporting their income or that we're able to track the right. income that they're making and categorize it correctly. And
right.
And yeah, that's the basic idea is it's tracked directly on a real-time weekly basis through financial tools.
Yeah, well, I mean, there's always going to, I mean, and I don't think that this should stop the development. I mean, but there's, I mean, even in our current tax system, that's an issue, right? So, I mean,
yeah,
that's just an issue.
Right. So there's a question of how, to what degree is it acceptable if small levels, edge cases of misreporting go on? Like when someone makes money under the table,
right?
It's not generally enough to like, you know, bankrupt the country.
Right.
Right. So we have to decide at what level is this happening? At what level do we need to address it?
Right.
And that's something we'll learn in practice.
But well, yeah. And then
as long as
you're
getting the bulk of people's income, I think this will work. It'll hold.
Yeah. Well, I mean, that's an interesting concept. I would love to, I guess we'll speak again next year at the next conference when you tell me how successful that new pool, that new thing is. But I like the concept of, we are not going to wait for those paid, what do we call it? Corrupt politicians to do
or
this.
Or incompetent. Or disempowered or whatever it is.
We're not going to wait for that. We are going to actually try to build a model. And who knows, maybe they'll decide, oh, I guess this stuff is going to work. And then stick with it. Let's go back to 2 years ago where you had this basic income. You told me that you were near the time where you were going to be able to evaluate the success of what people did with the money, et cetera. How did that work out?
It was pretty great, actually. So for those who don't know, I've been working on a docuseries called Bootstraps, and the premise of it was not to talk or philosophize or speculate about basic income, but to show it for real in practice.
Mm-hmm.
So we worked with Netroots Foundation, actually.
Mm-hmm.
We found 20 different people around the country, all different walks of life, different family types and households. And
right.
And we raised money to run a basic income experiment with them.
Right.
So they each received $1,000 a month per adult and $333 a month per kid
time, yeah.
for 2.5 years. We ran the entire experiment and saw what they did with the money.
Mm-hmm.
And we filmed it all. And I mean, it was great. It was, we were sort of gearing up for, you know, maybe some people won't use it as well. Maybe it'll be a slow burn while people get comfortable
right.
and then things will happen. I was sort of surprised by how quickly just the knowledge of that income, not just the money coming in, but the knowledge that it'll keep coming
right,
in.
Right, right, right.
And the trust, it unleashed people. The degree to which people started acting on the plans and dreams that they'd had for years and years and years, it was just immediate. It was pretty amazing.
It blows the theory that people just want to get free money.
Mm-hmm.
You know, most people don't want just free money. Most people want to feel relevant. Most people want to feel...
People want to matter.
They want to matter. And, you know, this theory that a lot of those in the upper structure believes that, oh, people just want to suck on the nipple or something like that.
We're resource accumulating robots. Yeah, that's bullshit.
Right. It is complete bullshit.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, completely. So, I mean, I'm glad that you guys did the experiment. I'm glad that the experiment proved the point that you thought in the first. Actually, it proved the point better than you expected it to.
And we were also actually not trying to make it prove the point.
Right.
We were trying to kick the tires, right? We were trying to do it as an experiment.
Right.
So we set it up in such a way that, you know, we embraced scary stories, people with addiction histories or criminal records.
Oh, so you actually looked out for folks like that as well.
Oh, yeah. We wanted to, like, actually take people's very valid concerns. How do you pay for it? And
right.
and what if people waste the money and say, oh, you know what? Let's see. Let's just try it
right.
and see. We're not trying to like trick people into UBI. If people watch our series and what comes out of it, our attitude has always been,
right.
and they come out of it with like a positive feeling about basic income, it will be because basic income sold itself.
Right.
Not
right.
because we sold it. We have no interest in selling anything. We
right.
want it. This is a journalistic and scientific effort.
Now, how does that tie in now? What you've learned, how does that tie into this new project that you're working on with the website?
So my role, so my wife is a documentarian, Daya Schlossberg, mm-hmm. and she's the director. Mm-hmm. We came on to the documentary as co-creators, but my role was more to design the UBI trial, do the research, help her like get to the shoots. And so I was, in terms of production, I was more of like a gopher and a helper and a producer.
Right.
And I'm the UBI expert. I'm the one who's like a more outward advocate for UBI right. in real life. So I helped design the thing to like best represent a true, honest UBI as much as you can with the right. pilot. And then she's the one who's in charge of telling the story, you know, mm-hmm. well and with nuance. Once the UBI pilot was done and the filming was all done, there's less for me to do.
Right.
So I stepped away and she's doing post-production and editing and stuff. And I had all this time and all this knowledge and some work I had done, like analyzing the economics of UBI. So the original founder of Comingle reached out to me and they had sort of a UBI-ish idea. Right. And I quickly said, you know what? I think we should make this pretty radical and there's an opportunity here. I want to join the team. So right. I joined that team full time like 2 years ago.
And how is it going? Is all the website calculations done yet? All the parts?
We've designed the thing in principle. I have like a working Excel spreadsheet version of the whole thing.
Right.
And we've raised about 40% of the budget we need to do the building and development. So we've.
Is it possible for me to ask you about what kind of money is we talking about?
So our budget is around $600,000 to get it to launch, is what we think, mm-hmm. and we've raised $200,000 of that, and uh-huh. we've used it, and we've built it into a place where we've got 15 beta testers,
right.
actually like having their bank accounts really tracked, and so working out the kinks because. Mm-hmm. We have a plan of like 5 stages of beta testing to right. go through to make sure, okay, are we doing the calculations correctly? Okay, are we categorizing income correctly? Okay, are we open to fraud? Okay, are we now transacting the money reliably?
Right.
Like there's a lot of steps to make sure.
Oh, that is a complicated.
This is people's money. You got
to
be trustworthy.
That's people's money. You have to have trust. And you also have to make sure that it doesn't bankrupt itself. It has to yeah. pay the people who are actually implementing it, et cetera, et cetera,
yeah.
et cetera.
Yeah, it's actually the thing that's really exciting to me is it has a revenue stream. Mm-hmm. So we set it up like a utility. We're not right. taking shareholders or VC money. We're taking right. grants and we're taking like limited
right.
investments where people get a payout and then they're right. done. But because there's a revenue set up like a utility,
mm-hmm.
We'll get 1% of the money that goes through. And at a certain point, that becomes enough to cover our overhead and our expenses. Right. And we're going to build it into the framework that what we're making is more along the lines of a blended nonprofit cooperative where once we're making more money than we need, we're redirecting and we have to redirect all that money back towards public benefit.
I was going to ask that question because 1% of a little is a little, but 1% of everything, it may be too much.
Exactly. So at first I was thinking, like as we get bigger and bigger, we can start dropping down the 1%.
Right.
But the 1% doesn't really feel like anything to the user on an individual basis.
Right.
So what does that actually mean where if we're bringing in about 50 cents per user per week, like at 25,000 users, then we can cover our operations.
Right.
At a million users, we're bringing in $500,000
right.
a week. What if we could do something better to actually help the users and the membership, like offer more tools and more services?
Right.
Like, so this is where it becomes really disruptive is we can start building out the tools the members want. Like how do you, like, what if we make something where the users can redirect a portion of their weekly payout into local funds
right.
and then vote on how it gets used and then all of a sudden start doing things with the commingle members
like
in
that.
Their community more than their local governments
I
are doing.
I like that. Empowered people.
Yeah. Start connecting people, empowering right. people in any way we can. And the beauty of having it run like a utility is we can and I will be promising that we don't monetize in any other ways.
Right.
So we will never sell ads. We will never sell personal data.
Right.
You know, we won't do any of that, the Facebook, whatever, Twitter shit, where it's like their existence is predicated upon profit.
Right.
If we divorce ourselves from that, we can make our existence and our mission predicated on maximum empowerment of the members, the owners.
I love where we're going, but let me ask you this before we close here. What's your background? I always like to ask the background of somebody who's doing this kind of work.
Like educational and
educational,
career.
Socially, how did you grow up? What made yeah. you feel that you wanted to work with people that, you know, that needed help?
I grew up like middle-class privileged suburb kid, you know, from Colorado. My background in education was I was a mechanical engineer is what I got a degree in.
Yeah.
I was never super passionate about it. By the time it was a smart thing and I was good at it, and I really appreciate that way of thinking, systems thinking and design thinking.
I'm a mechanical engineer.
Oh, cool.
Yeah.
I have a joke to tell you later.
Okay.
So my senior year in college, I'd taken an acting class and I was like, oh, wow, I actually need to try this. So I did like a year in engineering or like at Lockheed. And then I abandoned it, came to New York and commenced to be super poor for the next 12 years.
Oh, wow.
Trying to be an actor, screenwriter.
That's interesting.
And then I met my wife and she was coming off a like a step up in her career as a documentarian. And she asked me, you know, I was still trying to make my own stuff happen and mostly bartending and stuff. She asked me to produce her next documentary, and she was still figuring out what it was going to be, and that became Bootstraps. So I got launched into the UBI activism world. She is already doing a lot of environmental and stuff. And I now I'm getting to make films.
It's amazing how engineering teaches you logical thinking that can promote these things, because even UBI, right, does the logics behind how you implement all of this. The methodology that we get within the engineering
that's what struck me first, more than anything, more than the like the morality, the philosophy. I'm into all that.
Right.
But the very first thing that reached out to me was reading an article. Right when she was looking at her, she was getting ready to do her documentary and just being blown away by this idea that, that we can just do this, that we have enough money to just do this. And I guess the underlying assumption we all have, like I was in New York City, walking past homeless people like 50 times a day on my way to work or whatever. It's like, this problem must just be too big for us to handle, or else, like thinking, I would love if there was some efficient program that would take my tax dollars and effectively help all of these people get their
100%.
Subsistence.
Yes.
Like, I can't do it with my single dollars. I'm trying to make sure I can pay my rent. Mm-hmm. And how much is a dollar going to do one at a time for someone? Mm-hmm. So this was like a slap in the face. Like, actually, we have the money to just do this. And to me, it was like, well, maybe I need to look at the math and do the napkin math. And I very quickly, I was like, okay, we have enough money to theoretically do this five times over without the rich not being rich.
Yes.
You know, they still have a wide range of incomes and everything. And then the second thing that really appealed to me was I started posting a little bit like on Facebook. You know, you always have that one friend who's on the exact opposite end of the political spectrum who disagrees with you on exactly everything.
And suddenly agreed.
Mike comes along. His name's Mike. And it's like, it doesn't matter what I say. It's like, he has the exact opposite belief. After like and he comes along and I'm gearing up for like the painful argument. And after like two comments, he's like, yeah, I can see giving money to people. That just makes sense. Like, this is the first really nonpartisan idea that is, it's just mathematically design wise smart. And you can pitch it to, I don't care if it's a libertarian or a progressive or a neoliberal or an atheist or a evangelical Christian.
Doesn't matter.
There is a pitch. Because all it is power to the people.
Absolutely.
That's all it is.
You are so absolutely right. There's a reason why I wanted to talk to you back then. There's a reason why I'm enjoying talking to you now. Mm-hmm. You got to get your damn message promoted all the time. Thank you, my brother. Conrad, do you have any closer you want to say?
I just want to plug, if people want to go get on the mailing list to see when we launch.
Go
it's not a spamming list.
Plug it.
Comingle.us, comingle.us, and we'll let you know when we launch. And then if you want to know when the series is coming out, bootstrapstv.com.
Conrad, thank you so kindly for having been on Politics and Right.
Thank you so much.
All right.
Anyway, folks, that was so for people who just think, by the way, you can give me a call. I'll take a few quick calls right now, 713-526-5738. Again, that number is 713-526-5738. So, folks, it's not, you know, giving away money for people who just want to be on the dole. It's a mathematical thing that works based on how people, most people think and what most people want to do. So when people get down, when Betancourt and all those evil politicians try to take it to court to deprive a program that can give people a helping hand up that most of them will use to move positively. Remember, humanity is not such a bad thing. Giving a helping hand is not a bad thing. Helping folks get ahead is not a bad thing. And we do it with companies all of the time. Every time you hear tax abatement for a corporation, that's basic income for that corporation. Every time you hear we're building a street so that Walmart can build a Walmart and they don't have to build that street, that's a basic income. We have been taught to look at things a certain way. When we're helping the middle class, when we're helping the poor, it's on the dole or it's a giveaway. But when we're helping corporations, it creates jobs. The reason we're doing this is because they're job creators. Guess what, my brothers and sisters? When you give money to people that don't have a lot of money, there's an economic tenet known as the marginal propensity to consume. All that is some fancy words of saying the people who have the least will spend the most of what they've got, and in spending that money, it creates economic activity far exceeding the amount of money spent. Johnny, come on in.
I realized yesterday or the day before when I mentioned this about how people can handle $500 a month versus a $5 million lottery ticket because they're used to knowing the scale of money they can spend. I forgot to mention that the corporate industrial oligarchy, the guys think they own everybody and everything, you know, like the Rockefellers and the Trumps of the world. Those guys think that they know better than everybody and that they should be able to dispense money via charitable mechanisms. They want to spend. They don't like us deciding where to go. They don't like us deciding the direction of our lives. And I forgot to mention that. That was a key element. So,
well, Johnny, stop. No. Johnny, first of all, that's why you're the mayor of Politics Done Right, because that is an important statement that I needed to add. You know, the billionaires, the billionaires get favor with the middle class and the poor by the philanthropic work that they do. And what philanthropic work do they do? They go ahead and they give their monies to support 400 medical students, and they give their monies to support some great cause. And it's a good thing that they do it, right? But who the hell named them the authority to determine what needs to be done for other people? They singularly decide the outcome for many people. The truth of the matter is, right, as they giveth, they taketh away, right? And it's important. What you just said is so important. Who gives them that authority? Look at this young man who is mechanical engineer. They have an idea. They put it to the test. That is people power. That is real people working. And you nailed it, Brother Johnny. And I got to let you go so I can take another call and we'll talk later. Okay, brother?
Okay.
Thank you. Let's go to Brian. Come on in, Brian.
Yeah. Do you see the difference between Trump and Biden as far as like mobility, agility, mental function, all things associated with age?
Actually, yes. Yeah. I'm not. We don't even have to argue about that. Everybody can see with their eyes. When it comes to mobility, as far as the way that Biden walks and how Trump walks, Biden in standard walking, it's kind of discoordinated compared to Trump. But when it comes to riding a bike, etc., Trump can't ride a bike. He's too damn overweight, etc., while Biden can. So you're correct that there are differences. When it comes to mental acuity, I do see a difference as well. Trump is very dumb. He doesn't understand the rest of the world, and Biden does. Trump says some things that makes absolutely no sense. Biden makes a whole lot of sense. So you're absolutely right. I see distinct differences both physically and mentally. Biden is more fit but walks like an old man. Trump is much less fit, but he doesn't have that jarred kind of walking. So you're correct, Brian. Anything else you want to add before we go? I gotta get off now. Anything else real quick?
Yeah, Biden, Yeah, Biden can't even read a teleprompter script.
Okay, that's okay. There you go. That's not true. Again, and when we talk about intelligence, we can measure it. And Donald Trump is not intelligent. Biden is. Thank you, Brian, for calling in. And I got to go to brother Jack in the studio. Jack, come on in.
Well, it was a rough ride. It was a rough ride, but we still got it done.
Yes, we did. Actually, the rough ride was entire. Let me just tell folks, the drop in signal, etc., was entirely my fault. It had nothing to do with the geniuses in the studios. I had one of my channels set up incorrectly. So thank you very much for what you do, Jack. I appreciate all the work. And to those that are listening, appreciate your listening, appreciate your thoughts. I'm glad I was able to play the basic income story. Please go to politicsdoneright.com/newsletter to see the video about the publicist and Nicole Simpson, etc., as long as the other articles that I have there. My name, first of all, Jack, anything you want to say real quickly?
Negative.
All right. My name is Egberto Willis. This is Politics Done Right, and you guys know how I end this baby. I am what? Out.
We spend a lot of time deconstructing the news, trying to parse it into a form that everybody can understand. We try to find those little nitpicks where it flies above the fray, etc. If you really like these videos that we do, I want to ask a big favor. Please go ahead, number one, subscribe to our channel, and number two, please join if you can. Thank you so kindly for watching. Keep watching. Please remember to share. We must populate the entire internet with our progressive message, a message that we know is what most Americans say that they want. So help us, please join.